podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
Navigating and overcoming ethical challenges is in the job description of anyone who works in clinical research and drug development. Finding out if a new drug or treatment is safe and effective, for example, requires testing it in patients or initially in healthy volunteers. But it is essential to apply strict ethical standards to protect these study subjects. Occasionally, it is necessary to revisit these standards and evaluate whether it's time to change current practices. In the May issue of Therapeutic Innovation and Regulatory Science, or TIRS for short, a group of experts in research ethics published a special section of four articles on this topic, taking a closer look at four distinct aspects of clinical research that raise ethical questions for drug development teams. I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of DIA Global Forum. Today, my guest is the section editor and one of the authors of the special session, Dr. Lindsay McNair, Chief Medical Officer of the WIRB Copernicus Group. Welcome, Lindsay.
Thank you.
Lindsay is here to discuss some of the ethical questions that are frequently encountered in clinical research and drug development. So I thank you for joining us, Lindsay, and let me use your first name because we've known each other a long time. Let me ask you first, why is this topic important? Why did it deserve a special section in TIRS?
Well, I think you're asking a research ethicist, so I would be happy if every issue had a special issue, special section on research ethics. But I think, as you mentioned in your introduction, this one is important because it gave us the chance to look at some issues that are always present in the drug development work that we do, but sometimes even issues that we've dealt with for a long time. The community consideration of them changes. The way we think about them changes. We have a new philosophy on some of these concepts. And this gives us a chance to look at them with a fresh eye and in a new light, or to look at how the culture, just the general culture, and the culture in which we do clinical research has changed in a way that may change our consideration as well.
Okay. Let's briefly cover the contents and the topics of each of the four articles, beginning with the first one, which had to do with paying research participants. The practice of paying research participants has received significant attention in the past, as we know, but as one of the papers in the special session points out, much of the focus has been on what payment amounts are acceptable and not so much on how offers of payment may be advertised to prospective study participants. So let me ask you, has the way that we look at payment to research participants changed over time?
I think it has changed, and I think it's even changed a lot in the last few years. I think we used to be very concerned about giving compensation to research participants, even in some cases concerned about reimbursing participants for out-of-pocket expenses when they participated in research, because we were so worried about the concept of undue influence and influencing people to take risks that they would not otherwise take were they not getting paid to participate in the research. I think our attitude toward that has changed in that we now feel that it is an issue of respect to compensate research participants for their time, that we recognize that they're taking time away from their family, they're taking time away from work to participate in research, they're making a significant contribution, and we should recognize that by compensating them appropriately for the time that they're spending in the research enterprise, the way we compensate any other party in the research enterprise. And I think we're much less worried about the concept of undue influence now, because we really have seen very few examples of people who participate in studies. And these are studies that have been approved by an IRB, so the risks are considered to be reasonable. So you think that if the risks are reasonable, if an IRB has determined the risks are reasonable, then paying someone to participate in that research doesn't make the risks unreasonable for them to participate. So I think our thinking on that compensation has changed in that way over time.
In what circumstances does a payment for participation in the research study become coercion, if you will? You didn't use that word, but I'm going to use it. Coercion meaning forcing or applying undue influence on someone to participate.
So I think we're very careful about the way, and you're right, I didn't use the word coercion. I think we're very careful about the way we separate the concept of coercion, which is to get someone to do something by threat or force, and undue influence. And for the most part, ethicists feel that you really can't make payment to someone coercive. Offering payment is not forcing them to do anything. It is really going more toward the possibility of undue influence. And there, the situations that we worry about specifically are situations primarily in which someone may try to get into a study where, for them personally, there may be risks to participation. Maybe they're really not eligible for the study. Maybe they are tempted to hide something about their medical history because they want to get the compensation that participating in the study offers. And those are the situations that we do still worry about where compensation could be an undue influence.
For example, if compensation is, in quotes, excessive, for instance, compensation could be in the form of simply reimbursing out-of-pocket expenses for the participant to travel to the study site, right? And nothing more than that. Or it could be perhaps above that, above and beyond out-of-pocket expenses. What is the appropriate amount of compensation above and beyond out-of-pocket expenses?
Exactly. And I think that's why we are tending much more to separate the concepts of reimbursement, which is making someone whole again if they have to spend their money to participate in the study for parking, for transportation, for babysitting, as opposed to compensation, which goes over and above the expenses that they have to put out, over and above the reimbursement. And then the question, as you said, is what is appropriate compensation? And there are there's a lot of literature in the ethics community that tries to deal with this question, whether it should be based on minimum wage, whether it should be based on what that person would be making at work if they were at work instead of participating in the research. And there are lots of different philosophies of how that should be based. But for the most part, from the IRB side, we see very few protocols come through where we really think payments are excessive. In fact, we are sometimes recommending to sponsors that their payments are not high enough and that they really need to compensate patients more to make it appropriate for the time they're spending.
Does your last comment suggest that sponsors are perhaps very conservative when it comes to amounts of payments?
I think sponsors are very conservative. I think they tend to be even more conservative than IRBs sometimes, because I think sponsors are very worried about creating the impression that they are trying to unduly influence people to participate in the research that they conduct by paying them too much money.
A further question on this same topic. When it comes to disclosing information about payments in recruitment materials for the study, what are some of the ethical as well as practical issues associated with disclosing that information?
So I think the practical issues are that, for one thing, we never want a study that is designed but can't fully enroll, because that study will never be able to answer the research question. So one of the practical issues of disclosing information about payment is that it facilitates recruitment. People are more likely to participate if they know they'll get compensation. The ethical opponent to that is what we've already discussed, that then you do worry that the fact that you're offering that compensation, making people aware of that compensation up front, may make them subject to undue influence, and it may make them think, well, I really want to get compensated for the study. I just won't tell them about that part of my medical history. And so it may lead to a situation where there is undue influence.
And there would be a practical issue that could impact the validity of the study, could it not?
Yes, it certainly could.
Let's move to the topic of a second article in the special section, and that is adults that lack the capacity to consent to participation in the study. So clearly the main question is, what are the ethical issues that arise when including decision-impaired patients in research studies?
So I think the ethical kind of concept that underlies the enrollment of anyone into research is the concept of distributive justice, which is the idea that we want both the risks of research and the potential benefits of research to be evenly distributed across the population. We don't want one group of our population to take all the risks of research when they're not going to get benefit. We don't want to pick a sample for convenience because we think they're easy to convince to be in the research or unlikely to say no to us if we ask them, and ask those people to be in our research studies, even though the drug that we're developing would never be used in those people, or they will never get any potential benefit either from the study itself or from that intervention once it becomes more widely available. And we particularly want to be careful of this in people who are vulnerable populations, to make sure that vulnerable populations, including people who are what we call decisionally impaired, meaning they have either a temporary or permanent inability to make decisions on their own best interest, we want to make sure that those vulnerable populations are not taken advantage of in research by asking these populations to participate in studies where they are unlikely to derive any potential benefit.
What can researchers and sponsors do to assess when it is and is not appropriate and beneficial to include adults in research studies when these adults are not able to give consent?
In the paper that's in this issue, David Brasky and David Forster, who are two ethicists and experts in the regulatory issues around research, they've actually laid out a very nice framework for this. And it's kind of a spectrum to help both researchers and sponsors think about when it is appropriate to have people participate in research if they can't give their own consent.
I take it that people that are unable to give consent would have primarily a cognitive impairment, or are there any other kinds of impairment that are not cognitive but could prevent someone from giving consent?
For the most part, in decisionally impaired people, we are talking about cognitive impairments. Now, it could be a cognitive impairment that's temporary. They could come into an emergency room and be inebriated. They could be in severe pain and have gotten pain medication, which prevents them from being able to make decisions for themselves. Or it could be that they have a chronic neurological disease of some type, like Alzheimer's disease, which in later stages prevents them from being able to make decisions for themselves. But I think the framework that is laid out in the study kind of nicely delineates research where ethicists and IRBs would really find it inappropriate to include those populations in research. And then other situations, like, for example, if you are doing research on a drug that you hope will reduce the symptoms of moderate to severe Alzheimer's disease, you can't do a study of the efficacy of that drug without including people with moderate and severe Alzheimer's disease. So there will be some situations where it is not only appropriate, but necessary to include people with decisional impairment in your studies.
In those situations, does the IRB basically rely on the caregiver of the patient to provide that consent? And is that a relatively comfortable situation for an IRB to find itself in?
It is. When it's very clear that the decisionally impaired population should be included in the research, or that there is a very clear justification for including them, there is a very clear regulatory pathway to the use of a legally authorized representative. And IRBs are very comfortable because we do, certainly on our IRB, the second most common therapeutic area in which we see research is neurological diseases. So this is not an uncommon situation. And IRBs tend to be very comfortable with the use of legally authorized representatives in research as long as there's a clear justification for why that population is being used as part of the study.
We'll refer our listeners to the article in the special session on this topic to really examine the framework that you've mentioned, which is published in that article. Turning now to the third article in the special session, having to do with participants with opioid use disorder. Research participants with an ongoing opioid addiction have unique medical issues, as we know, and researchers are faced with novel ethical considerations and challenges when they plan, design, and conduct research with this particular patient population. Why is this issue important now?
I was actually one of the authors of this paper. I think this issue is important now because, as you know, certainly in the United States, we have an epidemic of opioid abuse that's happening. And there are a number of researchers and sponsors who are looking at ways to combat that opioid epidemic, both in terms of looking at ways to treat people who have opioid overdoses and ways to treat people with addiction to help them become non-addicted. And so in order to look at the efficacy of those interventions, whether they be educational interventions, counseling interventions, medical interventions, or a combination of those, medication-assisted therapy, you have to do the efficacy studies in populations of people who have active opioid addictions. And so there has always traditionally been a lot of concern about the use of people with active drug abuse participating in research. And so what we tried to do in this article is call out a number of those concerns that both researchers and institutional review boards have often raised, and to talk about kind of the literature surrounding that and what the best practices are going forward so that those populations can be included in this research and the research can continue.
Now, I can think of two types of studies where such participants could be considered. One is a type of study that looks at opioid addiction and is studying or investigating potential treatments. Are there studies where opioid addicts would be included in a study that has nothing to do with their opioid addiction? They just happen to be addicted. Is that an issue? The second type of study, trying to recruit patients that have an opioid addiction, but the indication in the study has nothing to do with it?
I think that certainly could be an issue. A lot of studies will include drug testing as part of the standard inclusion and exclusion criteria, which effectively screens out those people who have active addictions from participating in general types of research, which is not aimed specifically at opioid use disorder. What we really concentrated on in this paper is really studies that were looking at opioid use disorder, and that was the intended study population and the issues that came up in those situations, rather than the kind of inadvertent, or I don't want to say non-intentional, but the inclusion of people with opioid use disorder as part of a larger, more general population.
Nonetheless, we can think of situations where a drug is approved for a condition that afflicts opioid addicts in addition to other members of the general population. So it would behoove researchers to find out if there are any drug interactions that could affect opioid addicts that wouldn't affect people that are not on opioid addiction. The real world needs to have that knowledge, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
So do you see in your IRB work studies that are done with specifically to include opioid addicts to make sure that that knowledge does come to the surface as part of a broad drug development program for specific drugs in development?
That's a very good question. I would have to look back at some of the protocols that we've gotten in. I think a lot of the drug interaction studies, I think, are done in more controlled circumstances where there may be opioid dosing to someone who is not an active opioid user in order to look at the specifics of a drug-drug interaction in a more controlled way, rather than including people with opioid use disorder. But if you have a large study in which you're doing population pharmacokinetics, you may be able to get that data from people with opioid use disorder as well, being part of that population.
Finally, the fourth article in the special section focused on expanded access. Now, in the United States, there is a very recent advancement of state and federal right to try legislation. In fact, the U.S. Congress, I believe, has just sent this legislation to the president for signature. So there is new focus and attention brought onto expanded access policies and programs, and they're getting a lot of public attention. So my question, Lindsay, is what is the role of the IRB in the context of expanded access? Do all IRBs apply roughly the same practices in this regard, or are there differences from one IRB to another?
Under the FDA's existing expanded access program, and we're most specifically here talking about single patients, expanded access, or what we used to refer to as compassionate use. The approval of the use of an investigational drug as treatment for an individual patient. The FDA does have a pretty clear expanded access pathway, which includes the necessity for an IRB to approve the use of the drug in that setting. Now, what the authors of this paper did look at was exactly that question of whether all IRBs apply roughly the same practices. They pulled a convenient sample and looked at IRB policies online and found 100 policies from different IRBs, which looked at the approval of expanded access in a non-emergency setting, which is a different pathway, and whether or not those IRBs had very clear and detailed policies and procedures as to how they would approve the use for expanded access. And the reason that they wanted to look at this was to see how clear it would be for a doctor who wanted to use single patient expanded access to understand the pathway to try and get that access for their patient.
And so the paper suggests that there is such a diversity of approaches by different IRBs that a doctor's life may not be made very easy in this setting?
that may be the case. What the paper actually found was that many of the IRBs did not have clear policies in writing, so it was hard to tell exactly what their policy was. And so it may be very easy, but the doctor who's trying to investigate that pathway wouldn't kind of know until they got partway down it. Now, what is interesting, though, is that the FDA did make a change to their expanded access policy at the end of 2017, which was after the research for this paper was done. And the FDA now says that the IRB chair can approve the use of single patient expanded access without the application having to go to a full board. So that should make the process easier on clinicians who are trying to use this pathway for their patients.
Is there any cause for worry that the chair of the IRB could make this decision without the full IRB weighing in?
That's actually what the FDA has allowed them to do, that they are in the same way that expedited review can go through review by the board chair or a delegate without needing full IRB approval. The expanded access requests can go through approval by the chair without needing the full board to be convened for that decision. So it should help to facilitate that pathway.
Right, but as the chief medical officer of an IRB yourself and understanding what FDA is allowing, are you comfortable with the concept of the chair of the IRB making that decision without consulting other members of the IRB?
We are. It's actually a change that we had been hoping that the FDA would make for some time to try and facilitate this process. Because to be quite honest, that you know, expanded access is used for a single patient. There are cases where the manufacturer has already reviewed the intended use of the drug and has agreed to provide the drug. So there's already been some review from someone else who thinks that it's a feasible use. And really, the IRB at that point is just reviewing to make sure the consent process is appropriate. That's really what the IRB review primarily focused on, and making sure that the person who's going to take this investigational drug understood the risks of the investigational drug. And, you know, our chairs, our experienced IRB members are very used to reviewing that component of informed consent and that component of the research process. So the full board was not really adding that much to the decision making. And I think we're very comfortable that an experienced chair can do that just as well.
That brings us to the end of our conversation about this important special section. Dr. Lindsay McNair, thank you very much for joining me today and for sharing your insights.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
For the IA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.